And what I can tell you about the people at Essilor is that they have all the right intentions. They allowed an optometrist to sit at the highest level at what's called the leadership team, not only just the executive committee, but on the leadership team of only 7 people had the honor of being able to have a seat at that table. Essilor and J&J, so those are the two companies I can speak to, having spent 13 years at one and 10 at the other, really, really want the input of optometry. So let me just start that first. And it just makes sense. If you're running a business, you better understand your customer.
How's it going, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the 2020 podcast, bringing clarity to business, entrepreneurship, and life. As always, I am truly grateful for you taking the time to join me here to learn and to grow. And I have a very special episode. Today's episode is an interview with Dr. Howard Purcell, who is the president of the New England College of Optometry, my alma mater. His alma mater, in fact, he graduated from NECO in 1984. And his father also graduated from NECO 30 years earlier. So a pretty strong history for the New England College of Optometry within Dr. Purcell here. And Dr. Purcell has quite the background experience himself, having worked within industry with a couple of very big companies that I'm sure you've heard of, as well as working in academia. And now, of course, being at the head of one of the main optometric institutions in the country. I'm very, very excited to have this conversation with Dr. Purcell, to ask him a lot of different questions. We'll be hopefully diving pretty deep into a couple of topics that are kind of near and dear to me, but also he's such a fun, energetic guy. I'm sure it's going to be an entertaining conversation overall. So without hesitation, let's jump right in. All right, thank you, Dr. Purcell, for taking the time to join me here. I really appreciate it. I know you're a busy guy. You're very much in demand. So once again, I appreciate you spending the time with me here.
It's my pleasure.
So we'll start with some sort of kind of housekeeping or easier questions, things that I actually personally I'm interested to know. And I'm assuming if I'm asking the question, there's other people out there who are probably interested as well. And that is, can you define your role as the president and maybe compare that to other roles within the school, the dean or other positions like that?
Sure. So if that's the easy one, I think I'm in trouble, but I'm going to take that a shot. You know, people have asked me before, what do you do? It's not always the easiest question to ask. No, look, you know what? We have different ways we set up optometry schools around the country. So just to start with the basics, because not everybody is familiar with that. If you're part of a larger university, right, then the dean of the optometry school essentially runs the school, right? They have all the decision-making capabilities, but they do report to a university president typically or a provost. And that's the majority. There are only, to the best of my knowledge, 3 remaining independent private institutions. And at those institutions, which mine happens to be one of those, the head of the optometry school is the president. I'm actually president and CEO only because I have chief responsibilities for our clinical environments as well. So in any case, at our institution, we are the end of the road. There are no other, you know, presidents, any other provosts, etc. And I really like that because if you look at an example, just as one example where it can backfire on you, Nova, wonderful institution. I spent 5 years of my career there, and I love those guys. They're great. Yeah. But of course, you know, they had a little situation in which perhaps things were misunderstood about a contribution that was intended to be made to them. And there's where you get into a situation where the optometry school could think one way, the administration of the university think another. So I think when you look at big picture, I like the idea, personally for me, I prefer to live and die by my own decisions.
Sure.
I'll take the heat when it goes wrong and we'll celebrate when we have good things happen. So for me, I like that environment. Now at our institution, we also have a dean, but in a private institution, the dean is the head academic person, right? They have leadership and decision-making capabilities for the academic program. I'm not an academic. I don't come from that world. Our dean, for example, Eric Weisberg, has been at the institution since he graduated. He brings so much knowledge. He's been in so many different roles at the institution. I personally think for a dean, that is the perfect profile. They understand it. They've been in the trenches. And he and I can have great discussions because I come from such a different perspective than he does. At our institution, we also have associate deans, right? So our associate dean could be of the clinical side of the house as an example. So our clinical faculty have someone who represents them. So deans at a university setting, you could have your one dean that runs the institution. Deans at private institutions are the end of the road, other than perhaps board of trustees, if people are really interested. I essentially report to the board of trustees.
I see.
So they have issues, they do my review, they're, you know, looking after, you know, fiduciary responsibilities, et cetera. It happens to be, I was a member of the board of trustees at NACO, so that has really worked in my favor in knowing the board and understanding what drives them. It's been very helpful. So I hope that to some extent answers your question.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I, to be honest, I had very little concept of where the lines were drawn on that. So, and pretty familiar with Dr. Weisberg. He was there when I was at school at NACO. So that's pretty cool to hear that he's the dean. I don't think I knew that already.
Yeah, it's fairly new. He's been the dean for about a year, done an outstanding job. I just feel like, you know, the dean should bring that real experience of being in the trenches, sure. Et cetera. And Eric does that in such an incredibly positive way, and he's a great leader too. So that, at least for us, it works in our institution.
Absolutely. Well, you've already kind of alluded to this, but you know, your background is not so much in academia, you mentioned, but you've done quite a bit of work in industry, if I'm not mistaken, with J&J and with Essilor more recently.
Correct.
And I was curious to see how that experience then has informed or shaped your approach as the president of an academic institute.
It's a great question, and I think it's obviously had huge impact on me. And maybe I'll answer it by telling a quick story. So at the very end of my interview, the very last step of my interview, I had been called pretty much throughout the whole process the square peg in a round hole. I'm not an academic. I don't come from that world. I spent 5 years of my career in academia, and I appreciated it, and we laughed and joked about it. But at the very end of the interview, is my last interview with them, their final question to me was, so Dr. Purcell, tell us, you know, you've been called this square peg in a round hole. How are you going to round off the edges of that square peg to help it fit into the hole? And let me admit, you already know the answer, I can tell, but, or the answer I gave, but, it, you know, let me admit, first of all, I felt very little pressure. I was very happy in my job. I would have been happy to retire at Essilor and continue there. But to be the president of my institution, which is something I couldn't pass up on the opportunity. Sure. Anyway, my answer was, if that's what you're looking for, I'm not your guy. And when I looked around the room, I remember calling my wife and saying, hey, don't worry, we're not going to be moving the ball. I think that pretty much sealed the deal. But right. Nevertheless, that I think helps to answer the question. I come at it from a very different perspective. But I think at this point in time, it's not a bad thing. As I sit around the table with my colleagues at ASCO, and they're amazing people, most of them have spent their entire career in academia. Mm-hmm. And I hope what I can bring is just a different perspective. My time in industry allowed me to visit thousands of practices, talk to thousands of practitioners, try to understand as best I could the challenges and issues they were facing. Enabled me to be better at leadership and management and holding different positions at different levels. But maybe most importantly, I would have to say, and it really started at J&J. J&J has something called the Credo. And if your listeners or you are not familiar with the Credo, you should take a look at it. It was written by General Johnson, I think, a couple hundred years ago.
Sure.
And it basically says that when you have difficult decisions to make, here's how you prioritize. And for J&J, it's, you know, the users of our product and our patients that use us are number one. Our employees, our environment, and our shareholders. And you find that interesting, a big company, shareholders at the bottom. But what they'll tell you is take care of those first three and your shareholders will be fine.
Right.
And that really left an impression on me because we all have difficult decisions to make. I'm sitting in my office and what comes into my office now and the level I sit are the ones that people can't figure out.
Yeah,
there's good arguments on both sides. So all of a sudden, I'm supposed to be the smartest guy in the room, and I'm supposed to be able to know what the right decision is here, you know? And both people are making great points. And what I've learned, and I think this is probably the biggest thing, I learned a lot from industry, but this is probably the biggest thing. If you can share with people ahead of time, this is how we prioritize, that we're going to make a tough decision. This is the number one, number two, and number three thing we're going to look at. What I found happens, and it's really interesting, you have two people that just made their great points, and both sound very legit. And what you don't say is, well, here's what I think, so that's what we're going to do. I haven't found that to be quite as successful.
Yeah.
If I say, hey, guys, you remember this. Our priority, number one, is student first. That is how we make decisions. It's how we're going to make all decisions. If we agree on that, then clearly you two have both made great arguments, but your argument seems to me to be much more focused on student first. That's how we're going to go. And what I find is even though that other person who didn't get their way, is still okay with it because it wasn't just some person who thought they could make a decision. It was based on something we've all agreed on. And I saw the same thing at Essilor. Big corporates, and you work for Fortune 500 companies, you learn why they're Fortune 500 companies. If you prioritize and know what are the guidelines you're going to use, call it a credo, call it a prioritization, whatever it is. But if you all agree on it, it does make those difficult decisions easier. They're still not easy, but they become a little easier and you get more support because people understand how you're making the decisions. Right. And it's not just because you think that's what it should be. And now you get to sit in the big office. Therefore you make the decision. So I could probably list 10 more things, but that was probably the first one that came to mind. And I think about it almost daily. And so I guess that's why it comes to my mind when you ask, what is a great question. But I learned a ton. I hope that that experience I have will help guide the college to the future, because we're really looking towards the future. We're really trying to prepare our students for not only what we see today, but as best possible what we see out front. And what I bring there is, and one of my functions at Essilor was to look at everybody's new widget and the newest thing that was going to change the industry. So I got to see so much of that that I hope I can bring some of that, not only just to the college, but to academic optometry in general.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a fantastic answer. Thank you. And in that answer, what I love is that you've given me a segue to the next question. So I appreciate that. But
I'm here for you, man. That's what
you make my job easy. This is amazing. you know what? I love that the fact that that ranking system, and if everybody knows and has agreed on that, then that does, I mean, like you said, some decisions are always going to be hard, but at least the person who doesn't get their way sees why that decision was made. And I think that's very powerful in keeping a team or an organization institute working in the same kind of on the same path in the same direction. And it reminds me of something I learned about Jeff Bezos, speaking of large companies, which he was, when he's having a meeting, he's always got a chair for the customer. The customer, it's an empty chair, but he says, this is the customer sitting here. And so when they're having a conversation.
He's amazing in how he does things. I also learned something that I've implemented. When you have a tough project that you're looking at, it's way out in front, it's a long project. The way he approaches it, write the press release first. Huh. So sit down and write the press. You're just starting the project.
Right.
At the end, what do you want it to say? What do you want the differentiator to be? It's an incredibly powerful tool because now once you agree on that, and it takes a while to agree on writing what the press release is going to say.
Yeah.
But now once you agree on it, you know, now you can plan the path to get there. So Bezos, there's a reason why he's been the success that he's been. I mean, you could argue all different kinds of things, but overall, the guy's been incredibly successful, and he has some very unique ways. The one with the chair I've heard too, but that one I really like too.
That's a very cool idea.
Write the press release first, then you know what you're targeting, where you're going.
I mean, we talk about having a clear vision. That's about as clear as your vision's ever going to get, is what are you telling the world when the product's ready, right? So that's pretty cool. So you, the segue that you had made for me was talking about the future, and I know I've heard you say you're preparing today's students for tomorrow's optometry, if I'm hearing that correctly, or sorry if I'm misquoting that. But I was curious then, in your mind, what tomorrow's optometry looks like, however many years in advance you want, or in the future you'd like to go. And so what are you telling students that are in NECO today, or what would you like them to learn that would prepare them for that future?
Yeah, so here's how we approach it. And I've taken some heat for this, but I'm happy to tell you that I believe it's the right thing to do. I believe that our students should not graduate after 4 years of being in optometry school and not see some of the things out there that are disruptive, that are changing the way we practice. Even if I like them, don't like them, I personally believe I shouldn't be the judge of that. So the first step to it for me is I want to expose our students to everything that's possibly going on out there. I want them to be able to ask questions, to challenge people, to talk about it. And I will tell you, we've done it and we've started doing it 2 years ago. And our students ask amazing questions. They don't have the biases. They don't have the pre-existing kind of thought process. And they ask great questions. I mean, telehealth is a great example of that. So 2 years ago, we decided we were going to heavily learn more about telehealth. We were going to look at how we validate. And Dr. Chu, Gary Chu, and his team have been doing a wonderful job along with many. And it obviously came in handy 4 months ago had to step away. But another example, Warby Parker. Okay, we know our friends at Warby Parker. We've been friends for a while. Neil Blumenthal is the head of Warby. I've known him for a long time. He was going to be at Harvard speaking, and he said, hey, I'll come over to NECO if you'd like, and I'll talk over there. And I thought that'd be fantastic, just as one example. Students, I went to student council. Would you guys be interested? Absolutely, love it. We had a packed house. people sitting in the stairway, and we listened to Neil tell us about this incredible vision that he had. We listened to him tell us what an amazing entrepreneur and philanthropist he is. And we also listened to him explaining optometry, and it was clear he didn't understand optometry very well. And you know what? He recognized it, and he asked a lot of questions, and it made for great dialogue. And I think our students got a lot out of it, and I think Warby got a lot out of it. But I got a lot of nasty grams from people saying, how dare we let such a person even walk in the door? So my philosophy is, I owe to you, the student, to expose you to as much as I possibly can. Artificial intelligence, virtual reality, 3D printing of lenses and frames, you know, what we just talked about. So all these different applications, even though, and it's not about, do we think they're good, they're not. I think the student should have a chance to play with it, to utilize it, to involve themselves in it, and then ultimately make their decision as to whether they think this is something good or not. But I believe we owe it to them. So I am searching always with Gary, with Dr. Chu, to find out what is new and innovative going on out there. We want those people to come and visit us. The kind of unique thing, and you know this because you're an alum, there's a huge advantage to being in Boston.
Oh, yeah.
There's so much going on when it comes to healthcare, when it comes to, you know, IT, when it comes to technology. I mean, we're across the river, you know this, from MIT. We've got, you know, Tufts and BC and BU and Harvard and just Northeastern. It goes on and on. We're in a wonderful position to be able to take full advantage. And I would say over these past 2 years, I'm very proud of how things have accelerated. So I recognize that there are some who won't love this idea. But I think it's hard to argue that we should not present this to the student. They shouldn't see it after they graduate and say, what is this? I never heard of it. I didn't even know it was going on. So that's how I look at it. Yes, it's about, we say, preparing today's optometrist for tomorrow's optometry. We haven't fully assessed what we think is going to truly be tomorrow's optometry, but we work on that every day. And when we see something we think can influence it, be it positively, negatively, or we don't know, we feel it's important that our students have a chance to see it, touch it, feel it, play with it, ask questions about it.
Yeah.
To me, that's education. That's what you do in addition to the core principles. So that's really the root. There's a lot more to it, but that's kind of the root of the thinking. And I will tell you, the students have responded incredibly positive. They want it. They want more of it. And they ask incredibly good questions.
That's fantastic to hear.
I continue to be reinforced to do it, but I do occasionally take a little heat. You know, the other thing that's come up, and I'll just throw out there, is what should the relationship between industry and academia look like? This has been a little bit of a church and state kind of relationship, Amir, in many ways. You know, draw that wall, create that wall. We don't want either. Mm-hmm. I look at that a little differently, and probably because of where I came
right.
from.
Right.
But we cannot achieve the goals that we have set for ourselves at NECO, and I suspect this is true at every institution, without the support of industry. We just have to find the right balance. The industry doesn't want to come in and dictate our programming. That's not what they do. They want to expose themselves to students early so students know who's supporting them, that they're out there. Ultimately, their products have to stand on their own. But I believe we have to perhaps change the dynamic a little bit of the relationship between industry and academia. And it's why we started the Industry Collaborative. We have now over 60 companies that are part of it. I'm so proud of the work Gary Chu and his team have done to bring us closer, to talk to each other, to understand the importance of that relationship and what's okay and what's not okay, to lift up the hood and show people what's really going on in optometric education. Because I've said this before, and you probably heard me say it, in my old job, if I had these 2 years of experience in academia and went back to my old job, I would be 10 times better at my old job. Because now I really have a better appreciation for what the issues and the needs are.
Right.
And so our Industry Collaborative, part of the emphasis behind that, or the purpose of it, is to help each other understand the key issues. Because we all have something at stake. If we graduate a better optometrist, who, for example, is a better business thinker, because that's something we do very poorly today, in my opinion, and not just my opinion, I think in a lot of people's opinion in optometry schools. Just one example, if industry could help us, say, with a postgraduate course, because it's very difficult, as you know, to incorporate it into the 4 years. We do it, but it's hard for lots of reasons. But if we could create if we could create some type of accelerated 2-week program after graduation where people could come in, or even if you're out 1 or 2 years and you want to brush up on some of the business of optometry, that it didn't matter where you practice, you'd be prepared for a better understanding of the business. Just as one example, I believe we have to reframe our relationship with industry. And because I've sat in both seats, I think it's doable without inappropriate influence, but together we can do so much more. We don't have, I mean, think of this new entity, Essilor Luxottica, say whatever you will about them, you love it, you don't love it. The resources they have right now are immense. And if we can ask the right way, do the right things to get their support, we'll be able to do things that we've only dreamed of. So sorry, I'm a little bit on my soapbox on that
one. No, please, please.
I really feel strongly about that.
Yeah.
And for obvious reasons, I've been in both places and the intentions are good. We have our colleagues. We have optometrists at nearly, I think at every major company that supports us. These are our own colleagues. We need to be talking to them. We need to be more, my opinion, we need to be more free in sharing the real issues. What I learned when I was in industry were sort of the superficial issues.
Right.
I didn't really hear about the deeper ones that you learn when you come to academia. Some of the challenges like exist in any situation, but without industry support, and they want to support it. We had the meeting in Boston, is incredibly enthusiastic. We had our students, we had a panel of students and a panel of faculty talk to the industry, and those could have gone on for two or three more hours. I think it was one of the first times that industry was able to ask students, what is it like? And, you know, what are your challenges? And what are you thinking about? Ask faculty, you know, so are you the people that couldn't practice? So that's why you taught? I mean, it was a very candid conversation. And I believe our industry colleagues left there really impressed. I don't know what they expected our students to be, but I think they were blown away at the quality and caliber. And that's just not just NECO, of course. That's across the board. We have the best of you, and I know, I know you're going to agree with that. But there are great students throughout the country, and they just never have been really exposed to that. And I don't see any downside to that. In fact, incredible upside to that. When you're trying to form a partnership, the better you can understand each other, the better that partnership's going to be. You think of a marriage, you can think of, you know, a business relationship, whatever it is, the better you understand each other. I didn't really understand academic issues as well as I could have, and I had ultimate responsibility for supporting that.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot of amazing insight there. And I think there's a lot of comments I would probably want to make about some of the different things you mentioned, but to go back to the earlier stages of what you're trying to instill in the current students, it's hard to know exactly where optometry is going, but the fact that you're giving them this exposure, I think is extremely important. And I think the word that was coming to my mind as you're describing that was agility. And I think a lot of times in business these days, with the way everything's changing so quickly, when you have this information, you're more agile, you're able to jump on something a little more quickly. For example, e-commerce. I know you've spoken extensively about e-commerce and I feel that generally our profession was not just slow to move, but almost deliberately opposing it for a long time. And then COVID, maybe before that too, but COVID really like gave everybody a shot in the arm. Like, guess what? We got to go online if you're not on already. So I think that's really cool that you're doing that. And I guess since we're talking about industry, I did have some questions regarding that anyway. I had some order of questions, but it's really not that important. And in particular, Essilor, you know, you were there for a long time, and I'm, you know, it sounds like you had a great experience working there, and
I did.
Of positive feelings for the company. And you mentioned the merger, which I know left people feeling anywhere from ambivalent, like mixed feelings, to like holy. Right, what the heck's going on? My life.
I heard more of the holy.
Yeah. My career is going to end. Essilor is going to own the world. So you know, this is part of my question was, have you heard a lot of that, or are you hearing a lot of that now? Are students expressing any of this kind of concern to you as well? And then your personal thoughts. I think I already have a feel, but like your personal thoughts on an organization, an entity like Essilor Lux, having such a presence in our industry, is it good or bad? You know, yeah. And what do we look at?
Yeah, all good questions and important ones. You know, I have to caveat this by saying I know the people at Essilor. I don't know intimately all the people at Luxottica, although I've worked closely with them. And what I can tell you about the people at Essilor is that they have all the right intentions. They allowed an optometrist to sit at the highest level at what's called the leadership team, not only just the executive committee, but on the leadership team with only seven people, had the honor of being able to have a seat at that table. Essilor and J&J, so those are the two companies I can speak to, having spent 13 years at one and 10 at the other, really, really want the input of optometry. So let me just start that first. And it just makes sense. If you're running a business, you better understand your customer and you better be supportive of your customer. I also appreciate that when anyone gets super big, there's nervousness about that. So it really, to me, ultimately comes down to the people. All Essilor is a bunch of people trying to run a business and be successful running that business. The intentions of this combination of Essilor Luxottica had so much potential to really change things. Think about the resources they bring to the table. Think about if they went out there and continued to support things like telling people the importance of annual eye exams, getting out there and speaking about the, you know, what optometry does more. The resources are incredible there. By the way, even look at simple things like lens and frame. There's really rarely ever lens and frame are designed together. You have lens companies, you have frame companies. Mm-hmm. And now you have a company that can come together and do amazing things by actually having control over the frame and lens component. That's a really unique opportunity. Education, I mean, there's so much good that can be done. And the way that is dictated is feedback from colleagues. And so this was an important piece I wanted to make sure to answer your question here is, what you may think is, you know what, I'm a practitioner, I'm here, I call up Essilor, there's this huge group, they aren't gonna care what I say. So few people take the time to actually give that feedback. And I will tell you this, and every president I've worked for at J&J and at Essilor, and there's been a few of them, when I go to a meeting, the first thing when I get back, they're picking my brain. What did they say? What are people talking about? What are they interested in? Because so few people give that feedback. Mm. So if I had any words of advice that might be more important than just my experience at these companies, is if you have something to say, pick up the phone and say it. You may think that it isn't going to be heard, but so few people do it that industry, a good industry partner, is hungry for that information. So I would really encourage people to give the feedback, to make sure that you take the time to give the feedback. I read everything that came through to Essilor when people are saying either, you know, great or not so great, because I thought it was important we do that. So a good company is going to listen. You should speak up as much as you can. But here's the bottom line answer to that for me. And that is, this could go a lot of different ways. So set aside the frustration and try to participate. Offer your suggestions on what this entity could do that could be positive, that you would love to see do. Lastly, and I can say this now, I couldn't say it when I was part of the company. It does frustrate me that the two companies can't seem to figure out a way to get along. And that is really disappointing to me. I mean, at the level some of those people are, get over it.
Right.
And I apologize if anyone's going to be mad at me for that. Get over yourself and let's move forward and do things that are good for this industry. You, Essilor Luxottica, have such an incredible opportunity. Now, the whole thing between Essilor, Lux, or whatever you want to call them, and VSP, to me, just needs to, they need to work it out. A battle between those two companies is not a positive thing for this industry. And again, I can say it now, or I couldn't say this stuff before. There are great people at VSP. There are great people at Essilor. Figure out a way to have the conversation and think about your customers.
Right.
That's the key. And you're making this so hard on your customers right now, both Essilor Luxottica and having challenges of getting along, Essilor and VSP, get over it. Keep in mind what's best interest of your accounts and your customers, and we'll get things done. So I see this still having huge potential, but I would like our colleagues to speak up more, to understand you have a voice. They care about, they have to care about what you think. So speak up, send them a note, call them. Those things are really important. And so for me, that's the key message. I could, you know, pontificate about what I think is really going to happen. I don't know, but I know there's huge potential there. And think about you as a clinician, where you see that potential, shoot them a note and say, here's something you guys could do as an entity that would be hugely powerful for this industry. They have that opportunity.
Yeah. Well, I have to admit my experiences in that regard, sharing feedback and chatting with people within the company has always been a good experience. They always tend to be open, but that I'm just going to speak for myself, but that kind of nagging feeling of like this kind of omnipresent, you know, entity is always a little bit concerning for the independent optometrist, right? To feel like at any point in time, your whole career could just be kind of gobbled up. And yeah, that might be misguided.
Amir, if I can. Essilor cannot survive without the independent, at least in its current business format. So keep that in mind when you're thinking about, well, I'm a little entity, I have nothing to say. They cannot thrive like they have. Essilor was built on the independent. I think a lot of people think otherwise. Let me tell you, I've seen the numbers. I've been inside of it. I know what's going on there. Essilor relies on the independent to survive. It's critically important. They know that. We need to know that. And I would strongly encourage us to continue to provide that feedback. Rick Gadd is a great guy. I worked side by side with Rick for almost 10 years. He's a good guy. He understands it. He wants to do the right thing. Talk to him. And Millie Knight. You guys know Millie, I'm sure. She's amazing. She does a fantastic job. Talk to Millie. Let her hear from you. Because, you know, it's interesting. When you move over to industry, where they listened to your opinion before, now that you're one of them, now they want to hear from others. Right? It's really kind of an interesting dynamic. But you want to bring, you know, look, this is how I feel, guys, okay? But by the way, now I've talked to 6 of my colleagues, and let me tell you what they're thinking. That's so powerful. So powerful. I think we underestimate how powerful it is when we speak up and make a comment about things. It gets to the right people. When you have people like Millie in place and Rick and some of the others who are there, it gets to the right people. Now, I'm speaking for us right now. And by the way, you got Thomas and Swami over at J&J. I'm not sure there are 2 better people there either. Again, speaking for the companies that I've been a part of, they listen. And I'm not suggesting others don't. I think you know who the ones are who listen.
For sure, for sure. Well, I appreciate the insight on that one. Thinking kind of along the same lines here, I just want to make a comment about something that is going to lead me into the next thing. So Essilor, one of the concerns that I've had and spoken to colleagues about it is the fact that they kind of gobble up other companies and sort of, for example, owning multiple labs in our area. There were used to be independent labs and now they're owned by Essilor. So those types of things make people a little bit uneasy, but in particular, very personal and close to home for me. In 2010, right after I graduated, Dr. Purcell, literally, maybe actually just days before I graduated, the government here in BC decided to deregulate all glasses and contact lens sales. I'm not sure how familiar you are with this, but
I'm very familiar because it was right around then that Essilor acquired Clearly, and Clearly was the one very much involved in this.
Exactly. So there you are. So you are.
Imagine how it feels when you buy a company and they're in a lawsuit with your customer. That's never a good position to be in. I promise you. Yeah.
So that changed. You know, I was already, you know, on the fence to begin with, so to speak, but, you know, colleagues who had changed their perspective significantly because for the most part, optometrists and opticians around here just don't like Clearly, right? So the fact that Essilor bought them meant, well, Essilor is not looking at optometrists in optometrists' best interest. But that's not the road I want to go down here. So the question that I want to pose to you is more about the FTC regulatory changes recently in the US. And if you had any thoughts on those, because some of the statements that were made, I think, by Kelly Slaughter were sort of eerily similar to the statements that our health minister made here after our deregulation about, oh, it's in the patient's best interest to be able to go buy whatever lens they want. So, you know, the doctor maybe shouldn't mention the manufacturer anymore. I know that's not in the law right now, but that was a suggestion that was made. So I don't know what the chatter has been for you and with students and things like that.
Yeah, I think the students and faculty feel very much like you do. There's certainly concern. I think with the new FTC ruling or the update to the rules, I think the biggest concern there is it seems just overly complex. I mean, all right, you've already told us we're going to give them their prescription. Now you're allowing us to do it electronically, which totally makes sense and should have been the case from the beginning. But to now mandate that there's a signature and these type of things, to me, it just shows this lack of respect and confidence in a practitioner to be able to do what they're supposed to be doing. I mean, you know, I never had an issue with giving the patient the prescription, but to now make them go through these, jumping through 6 more hoops to make sure they get it and they're signing and this, it just seems excessive. And in a world where the paperwork, so-called paperwork, virtual paperwork has overwhelmed us, it just seems so inappropriate and so untimely. I mean, something 15, 20 years ago I could see, but not today. We give the patient their prescription, et cetera. The other thing I will say is we still have that first shot at all these patients, right? They're in your office, you've got your optical, you've got the offer of contact lenses, you still have that opportunity to do whatever you want to do or not want to do to make the sale to the patient. But I don't have any issue with giving the patient their prescription. They deserve it, they own that, they should have that. But to make us then continue to jump through 5 other hoops to make sure it's been done and it's been given to them and all this, and certainly I don't think any optometrist is going to agree with, well, you know, I don't write a brand or a base curve and you can just fill it with anything. I mean, anybody who spent 5 minutes as either a contact lens wearer or prescriber knows that's just ridiculous. And so you do scratch your head once in a while at some of the ways this is going. All that said, though, I think we do have some colleagues, and unfortunately, we tend to pay the price for those who wouldn't give the prescription, or, you know, you have to pay me, or something else. And this is just not ethical, in my opinion. If you're get an eye exam and you pay for an eye exam, that information is yours, and we should provide it. And so I guess perhaps we're paying the price for a real minority who didn't play by the rules. It just still seems to me to be very excessive. So I think what you were addressing was the FTC rule.
I was. And then what I wanted to ask you was, do you see, based on some of those other sort of separate comments, the potential for further deregulation anywhere similar to what we're experiencing here in BC? And what should we do, ODs do, to help hopefully prevent something like that from happening?
Yeah, I think patient education is at the heart of this. If I don't believe there's really any risk, I've worn contact lenses for 20 years. The worst thing I've ever had is a little redness in my eye that I took my contact lens out and I was fine. What I don't think as a patient is what great care I'm getting from my practitioner who continues to look at me and evaluate and make sure and preempt anything that's going on, right? I think about the risk here is almost zero. I've never had any problems. I wear disposables. I throw them out. This is great. So if the if I believe in my opinion that the risk is low, then all this other stuff sounds ridiculous. Now, I don't want to go so far as to now start to show horrible pictures about, you know, ulceritic eyes and things like that. That's the other end of the spectrum. But I think educating people when they come in for their follow-up visits, and we've gotten a little less aggressive with follow-up visits because, candidly, disposable lenses, people generally do really well, right? But at least providing, I think when we used to bring people in more regularly, and you could argue it was inappropriate, we didn't need to do it because most of those visits were fine, it at least gave us an opportunity to say to the patient, you know what, I'm seeing this, or this is here, how long are you wearing them, et cetera. I'm seeing some blood vessel growth. That's not a good sign. Your cornea is, you know, deprived from a little oxygen. Let's be careful. And, you know, so that they know what we're doing brings value. And I think because lenses we felt have gotten so much better and the risks are so low and we don't want to take a spot in our schedule for a follow-up because we just don't ever see anything, That's the upside. But the downside is we've lost the education. And what I've seen a couple of our colleagues do, and I love, all their contact lens patients get some regular education. Even if they've done great, they've never had anything, it's just good education to continue to provide them that, by the way, what you're doing does carry with it a risk. Mm-hmm. That risk, by the way, could potentially be vision loss. That's pretty serious. So let's just make sure we're keeping up. So I think education to me, and yes, I'm now an educator, so I guess this makes sense, but education to me is at the heart of it, because if I don't understand their risks, then why? What's the big deal? Why are you guys making a big deal? I can go buy those lenses anywhere. I can get it. For, oh, if you switch it, it's cheaper. Sure. Because I don't understand. And to me, that's where it has to start. Before we start fighting what all these people are doing, we would have a supportive consumer if they understood a little bit more. By the way, your most supportive consumer in this issue is someone who's had a bad eye problem, right? They had a bad consequence. Yeah. Those are our best patients too, right? Because they appreciate how fragile and sensitive the eye and the visual system is. So I believe really a lot of it honestly has to do with education. But to directly answer your question, do I think something like that could happen in the US? Absolutely. Absolutely it could. You have big lobbyists that have a lot of money to spend, and I think it could happen. We have to prepare for both. And I think the way you prepare for the potential of it happening is education. And I'm sure you guys in Canada are doing the best you can there, but the decision's already been made.
Right. Yeah, we've been playing catch up for 10 years, but you know, the patient education was really the key that was missing, I think, in the beginning. We also unfortunately had a bit of disarray in the ranks in general, with ODs and kind of not really seeing eye to eye. But luckily, that's improved significantly. But you know, I recently had a conversation with I know you're familiar with Dr. Jennifer Lyerly at Defocus.
Oh yeah.
About this specific topic, because she was interested to hear what it's been like in BC for the last 10 years. And my take was the two things that we needed to do years ago was patient education and then making sure everybody's on the same page and fighting in the same direction. I think in the US, I think the AOA in general does a really good job, and a lot of ODs are on the same page, but the patient education is exactly what's missing, like you said. So
I think it's critical. I would put pressure on the people like Clearly and others to say, play your part in that education. By the way, I think this is obvious, and I don't think my friends at Essilor would be too upset with me, because I do still have what I think are a lot of friends over there.
For now.
You know, Essilor relies on optometry.
Yeah.
So you have a little leveraging there to say, hey, look, guys, not so much just to say I don't like what you're doing with Clearly, but but more to say, have you thought of this? What would you be, would you consider doing this? Because these were things I was talking to them and to Clearly about when I had a louder voice over there. But we have a loud voice. That's, I hope that message has come through during this enjoyable conversation with you, is that we have a voice. Don't underestimate that voice that you have. You are such a critical, the you individually and the you as an aggregate. But just one person writing a letter, you, I think you, because I found it surprising when I joined industry, I think you would be very surprised at how far that letter gets and the impact that it has, because so few people take the time to do it. It's a powerful tool we have that we probably don't use often enough.
Got it. So if anybody takes anything away from this conversation, it is that you have a voice and you should share it. Write or call or email to the companies to let them know.
I encourage you to do that. And if you don't have connectivity with someone, call your colleague at the company. That's always a good place to start. And we have so many great ones that really are working hard. And they take a beating, by the way, if I may just add here. I really respect it. I've been in the seat. I was the spokesperson for Essilor. So you can only imagine when we acquired Clearly, when the merger took place, the combination took place. You know, I was out there talking about it. And these people take a lot of heat. And give them respect that they deserve. They're trying to do their best to represent you, but talk to them. You know, every day that we're out of practice and in industry, we become less connected to what's really going on. And I mean that with all the respect in the world for my colleagues in industry, but I was in the same boat. So we rely more on you guys to tell us what's really going on. We think we know, but now it's been 1, 2, 5, 10 years since we've really seen a full day's worth of patients. Right. So we need that perspective. Again, I'm hitting on the same things, but it's really important. Do it. Right. Speak up. Talk to your colleagues, particularly in industry. But anyone will talk to you. The president of any of those companies will talk to you. I promise they will. Don't think they won't. And if they don't, shame on them, and you should tell people they don't. The good ones will.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's good. That's really good to hear. I want to shift gears here quickly. Obviously, with a lot of the big things that have happened, there's been a lot of social change and unrest and a lot of discussions, particularly around diversity, about race, Black Lives Matter, and all these other things. And a few weeks back, I think it was a few weeks back, you had a conversation with Black Eye Care Perspective, Adam and Daryl, great guys. And those guys, I mean, they're amazing. They have a very clear goal and they're very vocal about it. And I love, because I had a conversation as well on the podcast with them, and they're very clear about, here's what we recommend, here's what our suggestions are, and the 13% thing was great, and I know that that's really caught on. But what I was, what I was really impressed with, Dr. Purcell, was in that conversation with your comfort level with it, but the initiative that you already have taken, and then when I was doing a bit more research, the diversity and inclusion stuff is something that you've been talking about from well before, you know, what's become kind of in social media and, you know, popular to discuss now. Thank you for that. And I'm curious to know, you know, what gave you that, what compelled you to kind of take that initiative? And now I know we've also received an email in the last little while about the steps that NECO is taking to, you know, pursue the D&I more. And I'd like you to share a little bit about that if you could.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to do that. It is something we are all pretty passionate about, and it's clearly an important issue in our society, and where optometry can play its role, we want to do that. You are right. 2 years ago when I arrived at the college after about 3 months of meeting with everyone who had a blood pressure at the college, everyone got an hour with me, it became clear to me that we had three key strategic objectives, and not to take time to go through all of them, but one of them was essentially, to boil it all down, creating an environment where all are welcome. I was so proud when I arrived at NECO to honestly see so much of the diversity that I saw in many ways. However, as you know, we, like others, have gaps. And for us, the gap was people of color, in particular Latinx and Black students. We just don't do well there. And I felt it was critical. There are other areas I think we do extremely well. And if you walk around our campus, you would see it. But it is blatantly obvious, and it's not unique to NECO, that our profession continues to struggle to recruit people of color. Mm. With, Mr. Floyd's murder and all of these things that have been happening as of late, it certainly has brought this more to the forefront. And I have a great deal of respect for what Black Eye Care Perspective is doing. Let me also back up and say, I have a great deal of respect for the NOA and the NOSA. I've been participating in them since I started in industry 27 now years ago. because I believed in what they did. And by the way, I just don't think it's a bad thing that Black Icon Perspective and these other groups have formed. This is not an indictment of NOA. It's saying we're going to help. We're jumping on board and we're all going to work towards this. So, you know, occasionally I brought up Adam and Daryl and some of the other things going on and people will push back a little bit, but hold on, be careful. This has sort of been NOA's domain. I love NOA. Cheryl Reynolds was a student of mine. I know her well. She's the current president of NOA. Great group. And I think together we can aggregate and really create some change. And that's what needs to happen. We have a problem. That problem is that our patients tend to look like us.
Right.
And therefore, if we don't have Black doctors, then we have a big problem. Right. And if we don't have Latinx doctors, then we have a big problem. We must be, in my humble opinion, representative of our community. We are, as you know, in all the community health centers. It is, I think, one of the true differentiators of NECO that our students spend time in a community health center. Mm-hmm. They serve communities, underserved communities. They see the importance. And perhaps most importantly, they also see the value of giving back. And so we have such a momentum behind that at the college. So we came up with a strategy that we felt would address that. That was 2 years ago. So we have now accelerated that a bit. What we initially did was we brought in a group that was intended to be an assessment group, right? It's called the Impact Seat. And they assess where we were and, you know, how bad were we? Where were our opportunities? It was enlightening, at times horrifying to think that, you know, perhaps some unintended biases that existed pretty significantly at the college that we needed to deal with. And I think if anybody did a true assessment of that, you're always going to find opportunities where you can improve, especially if you're trying to create an environment where there is a sense of being and belonging. But here's the bottom line. We are not going to meet any criteria that's been set if we can't get students coming in. Because we're never going to have faculty, and we're never going to have practicing Black optometrists, just as an example, if we can't start it at the schools and colleges. So I don't want to put all the pressure on the schools and colleges, but essentially that's where it's got to happen. Mm-hmm. We've got to get better at recruiting, in this case, Black students. Mm-hmm. And so we're working in many areas. I can quickly give you a rundown and maybe it sparks some thoughts on people's minds. One, we created a position that we had always had in mind. We're just waiting for the Impact Seat to finish their work, which is a diversity inclusion officer. Dr. Angela Abraham is taking over that role. She's amazing. She's going to do a fabulous job in it. I'm very confident in that. We formed two groups, an internal and external group, that are essentially diversity and inclusion. What are we calling them? Alliance for the Advancement of Diversity and Inclusion is one, and then the Diversity and Inclusion Council. Council's internal. That's made up of students, faculty, and staff. The external is just people in our community who have contributed to this movement and can help us be smarter about it. And that has been amazing, to be honest with you. We've also created some vehicles. We created a hotline. We went old school. We went with a suggestion box because we want people to just be able to write something down and put it in. Or you can call the hotline or you can send an email to voice@neco.edu, giving you three different ways to give us feedback. Because part of the feedback from the team who came in to assess was people didn't always know where to go if they observed something or they felt something uncomfortable. We want to make sure there's lots of resources and vehicles to provide that feedback. Training. Obviously, we want to do training for everybody. And that means mandatory training when you come in. And that means incorporating within our cases that we present, within our leadership courses and our other type of courses that are amenable to this, to include cases that involve these types of issues. So we talk about how you deal with it. And I'm really excited about how that's going so far at the college. One of the other things we did, which has probably turned out, and I wouldn't have expected this, to be honest, to be one of the more controversial things, was, you know, I've heard for 2 years, and I'm sure my predecessor Scotty has heard it many years before me, that people love our facility. It's sort of the Hogwarts of optometry. I've heard that many times. Our building is older, you know, it's a classic historic building. It's just gorgeous. We all love working in there. And when you walk around, there's some beautiful portraits up on the wall, all of older white men. Mm. And reality is, these are the people who've contributed to our institution. But I heard over and over that, has any woman ever contributed to anything that happened at NECO? Has any person of color ever contributed? And by the way, when we started soliciting, there are so many who have. There are incredible women who've contributed to NECO. There are incredible people of color who were the first to do so many things out there. Mm. We want to recognize them. So we're going to rearrange some things, and we're going to try to diversify. Well, I will tell you the response to that, and it, I think I told you this earlier, 95% of the responses to what we did have been positive, but there have been a few people. And I think this one in particular, and I guess I tie it to, there's been this correlation that if we're moving some of these portraits, these must be bad people. Right. These are not bad people.
Right.
We love these people. They're our history. But at the same time, we're just going to show more of our diversity. But I mention it because it apparently for not many, two that I heard from, that really upset them. And let me just say, if they're listening, because I know a lot of people listen to the good stuff we put out there, these are not bad people. We are not suggesting these are bad people. We're just suggesting we have a diverse contribution and we want to just be proud of that as well. It's not in place of, it's in addition to.
Right.
And so I hope people will see that, and majority do, by the way. But of course, human nature is you think about the ones that have been critical and have given you a hard time and you really scratch your head. Well, wait, do they really understand what we're trying to do? And I don't think they do, because I think if those couple of people who did give the negative feedback did understand, I think they would be supportive. Right. I respect our history. Believe me, our founder, Dr. Klein, started this institution just up the road from us 125 years ago. I love our history. I can't learn enough about it. It's so critically important to me. But we're at a very interesting time in our world right now and the sensitivities that exist, but we believe it's the right thing to do. We're going to continue to do it. Last just couple of things, we set goals, and that's where Black Eye Care Perspective helped us. It's the 13% promise that you mentioned. I hope a lot of my other colleagues at other schools and colleges and other entities will take them up on this. It's a lofty goal over 5 years to get to, just as one example, today we're 3% students. Mm. We need to get to 13. That's a big hurdle, but you know what? If you don't set lofty goals for yourself, you'll never get there. Mm. And you know, by the way, I'll just say this, and I don't mind saying it. If in 5 years we're at 10%, I will celebrate that we went from 3% to 10%. We will have a party, we will celebrate, and we will continue to work towards getting ultimately to that magic 13%.
But if you get to that 13%, Adam promised he'll make a plaque.
He promised more than that, by the way.
That's true, but at least you'll get a plaque on the wall at the very end.
Yeah, no, we will all celebrate. And I really salute those guys for giving us something tangible, because when you can have something you can work towards, something you understand, okay, we all know it now, that's what we're working towards, I think it really helps. You've got that target out there. You've got something you look forward to, like writing the press release at the end, right? You know where you're trying to get to.
Yep.
And then lastly is just a biannual report. So twice a year, we will report to the institution and publicly on our website, how are we doing at moving towards these goals? So I thank you for letting me talk about it. It's something we're very passionate about. I hope our alums understand that what we're trying to do. And as I said, probably 98% of them do. But for those of you who don't, I want to make sure they know. They can call me anytime. They can talk to me. I want to hear their issues. I want to understand where they don't agree or where they do agree. And there'll be some situations I won't be able to change people's minds. I appreciate that. But at least if they have the facts and then they still feel it's not good, then that's fine. If they really don't feel that's good, then talk to the Board of Trustees and let them know you want a different president. I mean, that's your other course of action. But in any case, we're doing what we think is the right thing. And the support from students and faculty and staff has been absolutely outstanding. Honestly, that's my constituency. Mm-hmm. I'm dealing with 21, 22, 23-year-olds. They're very passionate about their position, and that is my constituency today. That's my customer. I know they don't like when I say it, and I don't say it often, but they are my customer, and I have to serve the needs that they have and to assure the college continues in this incredible trajectory that Scotty left it on. We are just so pleased with where we are and where we're going, and having wonderful alums like yourself who continue to demonstrate the quality of the student that comes out of our institution and others. We're very proud of what you've done and how you continue to not only just serve your patients, but also support our industry, because it's easy to let everyone else do that. So I congratulate you on what you're doing, and I'm honored to be a small part of it today.
Thank you. I'm truly grateful for you taking the time. And I think this is a good place to kind of get close to wrapping up here. I always ask two questions at the end of every podcast.
Save the tough ones for the end here. Is that?
Well, you know what? They're a little more personal, maybe make you reflect on yourself a little bit. But, the subtitle for the podcast, it's called the 2020 podcast, but the subtitle is Bringing Clarity to Business, Entrepreneurship, and Life. And I think there's been a lot of that covered in today's conversation. So it's not your standard... tell me about this specialty within optometry. I'm trying to bring in outside perspectives, and I appreciate you doing a lot of that today. And these last two questions are sort of meant to, for you to share some thoughts that could help inspire, you know, ODs and ECPs who listen to this. So the first question is, if we could jump in a time machine and we could go back to a time in your life that you were, it was a particularly difficult time. You can share the specific moment if you'd like, but more importantly, I'd like you to share what advice you would give to yourself in that difficult time.
Wow. Okay. First one that comes to mind, and only because I've been talking about it lately, because people ask me why my passion for this, and I think we all have our life experiences, and I've so been influenced by listening to stories that Adam and Daryl have brought forward to us, people I know and care for, and hearing their stories that are horrifying to me. My friend Terry Ingram, who unfortunately passed away far too young, telling me the story of being the first graduate at UAB, optometry, and how difficult it was for him, and how he wasn't treated very well. And then he became an executive at J&J, and many of the people at UAB who wouldn't even talk to him or help him with any exams or anything, all of a sudden became his buddy and wanted to, hey, Terry, my bud, what's going on? Can you help us to support this and that? And as soon as they would walk by us, we'd keep on and we'd say, see, that guy wouldn't even talk to me in optometry school. So hearing other people's stories is incredibly impactful. So mine pales in comparison to something like that. But my story is a little bit of, you know, what would I learn from it, do different, is high school. So I went to high school in Miami Beach, Florida. And at the time I went to high school, we had busing. And so Miami Beach High had 50% black students, 50% white students. And it was a very difficult time to go to high school. We had motorcycle cops riding through our hallways. We had race fights almost on a weekly basis. Black students over here, white students over here. And what I recognized afterwards, I had no idea what was the cause. What was I even fighting for? What was it? And I learned so much, and I wished at that point in time I could have been more of an advocate. I wish I could have stepped up. I went along with everything that was going on. And if I'm white, I should be standing over here. And my black friends had to be standing over there. And, you know, I wished that I'd had a little bit perhaps more sense of the importance of that type of situation. It left a lasting impression on me. There's just no question about it. However, I wished I could have done a little bit differently, maybe done more to influence that. So I did have some friends who did, and I admire that they did, but most we just sort of followed along, and we didn't even know why we were following along, and that's the saddest part of it. So if I had to do that one again, I would have stepped up a little bit more. I would have spoken up a little bit more. I would have tried my best to minimize it. Having said that, though, having had that relationship or that experience, I wouldn't change it because it has made me a lot of who I am in understanding a little bit better how that can feel and how you can feel in being separated because of something that is about you and who you are. I can't say that I've walked in the shoes. I absolutely can't say that. But what I can say is that influenced me. And because we just came off of the discussion about race and those kinds of things, I guess that was what was in my head, that that situation has made me a lot of who I am and how I handled it and how I learned from it. I did ultimately learn from it, but it took maybe longer than I would have liked.
That's a very relevant, obviously very relevant situation and experience to share. And I think an important one, because a lot of times, you know, lately, with social media and things like that, maybe there's been a bit more encouragement for people to get involved today. But even just a few years ago, I think there was plenty of people feeling that same way. They don't know if they should step up. They don't know if they should have a voice or be out there. So it's good to hear that from somebody in a position like yourself to share that. So hopefully that'll encourage people to speak up more when they feel like they should be taking a step towards helping a certain situation. So,
no, thank you. And I'll tell you, if you don't mind me saying this, next week we're doing something with the Vision Council. They asked me to facilitate. It'll be very interesting because I've already heard a few comments on this. So it's going to be a group of white colleagues talking about this issue. Hmm. And most of the people who know and care about me tell me that I'm nuts to even try to do this.
Yeah.
But I think it's important, and I hope some good dialogue can come of it that is helpful for people. But I respect you for allowing to have platforms like this, to have some important discussions. Wherever we can continue to support what you're doing, we will do. And I hope you'll continue to tackle the difficult subjects, because I think it's important that we do, that we have the dialogue, that we have, respectful dialogue And we should be able to do that in this profession. And I said this the other day, and I'll say it again. I think optometry could really lead the way here to really show what can a profession do to change and adapt and be more inclusive and more diverse and more equitable. All these words that are incredibly important. Now, this allyship, which is what the show is going to be about, I think you even mentioned that. I had to look it up the other day because I really wanted to understand. I thought I had in my own mind what allyship meant, right. But what was it really? So building relationships based on trust, consistency, and accountability, taking on the struggle as if it's your own. Mm-hmm. And I think we owe it to our colleagues,
for sure.
Our colleagues of color in particular, to take on this struggle as if it's our own, because we're not perfect. And my colleague who said to me, you know, NECO has never been racist. It isn't racist today. It never has been. I respect that. I respect that position. But I do have to say, we have a lot of room to improve. Hmm. And it's not perhaps direct racism, and it depends on how you define it, but we have a long way to improve. At the very least, if a black student walks into NECO, I want them to see some people who look like them. I want them to feel comfortable there.
Yeah.
And it's a chicken and egg story, though, right? We've got to get the students in order to get the faculty. But we are working hard, and ASCO, by the way, not just NECO, is working hard at trying to come up with solutions to this. And I think part of it is really going to come down to money, unfortunately, and it's scholarships. And I hope that our industry, which already has been incredibly generous, will continue to look at opportunities for scholarships, because we want the best black students to come to optometry. Don't just want the ones who nobody else wants or who thought about medicine and then they'll fall back on optometry. I want the best students to look at optometry and say, I'm going to change people's lives every single day. I'm going to make a good living. I'm gonna, you know, be a professional and a doctor, and I'm gonna have a good work-life balance. I think we should be able to convince the top students to look at optometry because of that, and I'm committed to making our best effort, as I know others are, to be able to do that. And I hope, you know, what happened is horrible over these past few months, but if, you know, I listened to, last thing I'll say, I promise, I listened to the dean of Harvard Business School, incredibly smart guy, as you can imagine.
Yeah,
and I'll leave you with this thought, unless you have, I think you may have had one more question for me. But anyway, I'll leave you with this quickly. He said that we have a huge opportunity. 400 years, this has been building. And when we think back of the greatest generation, we talk about the greatest generation, our forefathers who fought for our freedom, that people could look back on our generation, and I'm including myself in yours, even though in the aggregate of this generation, we have a chance right now to make a difference and to be one of the best generations who really finally said, enough is enough. We're going to move forward in the best way we can to provide equity, diversity, inclusion, at least in our profession, which is what we have control over. And that really has stuck with me. We have a huge opportunity here. Let's not miss that opportunity to make a big difference.
Yeah, that's fantastic. To look at it as an opportunity. I know that's difficult in the earlier stages of a change like this, but very much can be that. So the last question that I wanted to ask you, and this one could be a shorter one, up to you.
is, I think it's going to have to be.
I apologize. I know you're...
No, you're fine. You're fine.
With everything that you have accomplished to this point, and you know, now being at the head of an academic institution, how much of what you've accomplished to this point in your life would you say is due to luck, and how much is due to hard work?
It's probably an easy, short answer. I have always been the person, I haven't shared this very often, by the way. I have always been the person who had to work a little harder. You know, my classmates who I lived with, they could read over the notes once, they get B's and A's. They could do a lab once and they'd be great. That has never been my situation. I've always had to do extra work when others could just look at it once, I had to look at it three times to get the same grade. Just who I am. In the clinic, I always did extremely well, but didactic, you know, in the classroom, I'm not the straight A student. You know, I had to work harder at it. And I think as a result of that, I have definitely had some luck. There's no question. I've had some luck. But I would like to say, because along my career, I've always had to work a little harder to perhaps get the same as someone else did.
Yeah.
I look at that now as a huge advantage, because it's just always been in my MO. I know I got to sit down a little bit longer. When I think I'm done after an hour of looking at it, I'm going to stay another 30 minutes and look at it again. And I think that probably is what has helped, maybe. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I'm not any smarter than anybody else, but I've had an incredible ride in optometry. I've been able to be in private practice with my dad. I've been able to be at a new school and help start their contact lens program. I've had J&J, an amazing American company, for 13 years of my life. Move over to Essilor, a French company, just taught me so much. And now I get to come back to my optometry school and act like I know something. I mean, it's incredible. So it's a little bit of both, I think, for everybody. But my direct answer to you would be, I've always had to work a little bit harder. And so as a result of that, I think that's just who I am now. I feel like I always have to put in that little extra to just be on par. And where I saw it as a disadvantage, honestly, when I was in college and even a little bit in optometry school, today I actually see it as an advantage.
That's fantastic.
I hope that answers.
No, that's great. Yeah, well, I mean, some people give me a percentage. So if you want to give me a percentage, that's okay.
No, I don't know if I could give you, if I had to give a percentage, it would weigh heavily on the working harder. But there's no question I've had some luck.
Yeah.
I think we all, as you said, people are going to give me a percentage. I think we all feel like it's some balance of the two. I've heard some people say it's just been all luck, and I look at them and I know they've worked their butts off to get where they are. So I think it's always going to be a combo, but it's been fun, man. I appreciate it. Really
thank
do.
You,
I,
thank you. Well, the last thing is, how can people connect with you, social media or email?
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier, thank you. Necco Prez is always a way you can, but my email is purcellh, so P-U-R-C-E-L-L-H at necco.edu. Love to hear from alums. Love to hear from anybody. If you have thoughts, comments, like what we're doing, don't like what we're doing, we would love to hear from you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to say that.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Purcell. I really, really appreciate you taking the time. And I look forward to talking to you again sometime soon.
All right. You just have to promise me one thing from here on out.
Yes.
Call me Howard.
All right, Howard. Thank you very much.
All right. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, there you have it, guys. That was the interview with Dr. Howard Purcell, president of the New England College of Optometry. I hope you found that very insightful and informative. As I mentioned in the intro, Dr. Purcell is a very energetic, fun guy to have a conversation with. If you like this episode, as always, please share it, take a screenshot, throw it up on your Instagram story, tag me, and tag Dr. Purcell at NeccoPrez, P-R-E-Z. I'm sure he's gonna be happy to hear from you as well. Tell us what you took away from this. And if you have any further questions so we can keep chatting a little bit more. Thanks again, guys. We'll see you again with another episode real soon.